We're trying to conduct a serious scientific investigation.
Science, logic, reason.
Do you have any hard data?
Now that's what I call science. Hello, listeners. You're tuned into That's What I Call Science, the weekly radio and podcast show bringing you independent and interesting STEM, so that's science, technology, engineering, maths and medicine, from Tasmania. This show is supported by Edge Radio, Hobart's premium news station, so head on over to edge.org.au for more information about them. I'd like to begin today's episode by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we are recording, the Palau and Pākana. We're recording here on Lutruwita, but as we are a podcast, I'd also like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land from where you, our listener, are tuning in from. On behalf of everyone here in the studio, I pay my respects to elders past and present. My name is Ollie Dove, and I'm joined today by my co-host, Sarah Lydon. And today we are discussing chemistry and engineering, a double up team, with Tim Jessop from Currawong Engineering, but I'm going to pass on over to Sarah to introduce our guest a little bit more.
So Tim is a engineer and chemist, you sure. Say both of those?
Yeah, I'll take both, sure.
Who's had quite an interesting career doing some chemistry things and some engineering things, including things with mass spectrometers, jetpacks and drones.
Yeah.
And yeah. Tim is originally from Tasmania and has just recently come back to continue his career here, which is quite exciting. So, Tim, can you tell us a little bit about what type of engineering work you do and what inspired you to become an engineer?
Sure. Well, the kind of work I do is mostly focused around electronics. Mechatronics is what I studied in university, but most of what I do is... Well, mechatronics is kind of automation and robotics usually is the focus. Most of my work has been more around the electronic side of things, so less moving parts and more the circuit boards and things that control stuff. What made me want to be an engineer? I actually originally wanted to be a scientist more than anything. Engineering was kind of something that I decided to study in uni because I thought it'd be a good challenge I learned some interesting stuff. And since graduating, I guess I've done a bit of both, but engineering has ended up being most of my career since graduating, I guess.
And where does chemistry weave in and out of, are you doing both at the same time or have you dabbed in and out?
Both, I guess. So right after I graduated, I got to work for a couple of years doing analytical chemistry for a zinc smelter here in Hobart. And then for another few years after that, I was mostly focused in electronics and mechatronics engineering. And then the last job I had before moving back to Tasmania, so this is in New Zealand, was for a company called SIF Technologies, who actually make a kind of chemical analysis device, a real-time mass spectrometer, which was a great chance for me to, I guess, apply both chemistry and mechatronics to my work.
What is a mass spectrometer?
A mass spectrometer, there are a few different kinds of them. Basically, it's a way of measuring the mass of a molecule. So if you have an unknown sample of something, then a mass spectrometer can tell you the size of the molecules within it. And depending on the type of mass spectrometer you have, you can analyze liquids or gases or sometimes even solids, and you can get more information than just the mass as well. So you can learn about the reactivity of the sample.
So, Tim, you're quite famous for your brownies and the very scientific process you went through to find the ultimate brownie recipe. Could you tell our listeners a bit about how... Your background has maybe informed how you've gone about seeking?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I started making brownies back in, 2016, 2015 maybe. And it was just a bit of a whim. I just decided to make a batch of brownies and it didn't turn out particularly well. So I made another batch with a different recipe and it also didn't turn out particularly well. And at some point, my ego felt a little bit threatened that I'd repeatedly failed to make, you know, one of the simplest recipes in the world. And so I kind of took it personally and decided to see if I could get this right. So I put out a call for recipes for my friends and got about six different recipes that I tried and made and then started comparing and optimizing. One thing led to another and suddenly I'd done 70 batches of brownies and still not quite perfected the recipe, but I think I now understand it a lot better. And yeah, it's been a real scientific process. So a lot of weighing and splitting batches into two. So I've got an experimental group and a control group.
So that's 70 since 2016. That's not 70 batches in 2017.
No, not quite that many. But I think the most I did in a year was probably around 20, 25 maybe.
Wow, once a fortnight. Were you eating all of them or were you able to distribute?
Oh, my colleagues at work were very supportive of this this experimentation. So, and it definitely came in waves. Like I would make no brownies for a little while and then I would make a batch. And then something would go wrong was usually the way it happened. You know, the surface wouldn't, rather than being shiny and cool looking, it would just be like gross and I don't know, a bit too dry or something. And so I would have to make like three more batches over that weekend to just figure out where I went wrong and what happened and what had changed. And then once I understood that little niggling thing, then I would, you know, maybe stop for a while and just go without brownies for a while.
When you reach the optimal brownie recipe, are you going to publish it and share it? Is this a paper? Is this a recipe?
Yeah, yeah, I did actually release like almost a research paper with the recipe in it and then all of my findings about the different ingredients and the method and everything. I did release that once I got to about 50 something. I think I was up to about 50 or 60 batches at that point. Because I was quite satisfied with the recipe. There are still several mysteries that I think need to be cracked. And I have done a bit of work with mass spectrometry to look into those as well. It's mostly around the butter now. The butter is the main problem.
Oh, yeah. Wow. That's incredible to think mass spectrometry and brownie in the same sentence. But in terms of butter, looking at it from a scientific point of view, what's going on there? What's the mystery that you have to solve?
Okay. So one of the big breakthroughs I made when making brownies was browning the butter. So you can just add butter to a recipe and it works fine. But if you put it in a saucepan and heat it, what happens is you evaporate the water. The water kind of all bubbles off and boils off. And butter is, to go back a step, butter is about 80% fat, about 18% water, and about 2% milk solids. And what happens when you brown butter is you evaporate off the water and then you toast the milk solids. So it's kind of like just, yeah, cooking them, toasting them. You raise the temperature. Once all the water's gone, the fat that's left and the milk solids can get to a temperature around like 140 degrees or so. And then it starts making all these fascinating reactions. So they're commonly known as caramelization and Maillard reactions. And those are kind of the sort of reactions that make all of our food, our most delicious food, incredibly delicious. So think of toffee and just toast, like toast compared to bread flavor-wise, or like bacon. A lot of those smells come from, like the smells and the taste come from those caramelization and brown Maillard reactions. So yeah, if you can find out how best to brown the butter, that makes a big difference. But what I found was that I got a lot of variability between batches of butter. And that was very annoying because I found a huge amount of flavor was introduced by browning the butter. But some batches turned out really, really well and others not so well. So at different points, I browned like five different brands of butter and just, you know, had blindfolded my wife and had her sniff all of them in turn and sort of rate them all and put them in order. And then we would sort of, you know, go back. And eventually I went to the manufacturers of the butter and I asked them, what is it about your butter that works better than the other butter? And what time of year did you take this? So I had to unravel their dating code on their packaging to figure out exactly when the butter had been produced that was in the supermarket. And I'm still not there. still a bit of a mystery. So
how many more batches do you expect it to take until you get there?
A few.
I think it's gonna take a few. There's another 70 or?
There's not a lot of research on the browning of butter. And I've read a few papers, but yeah, I haven't found any great information that links or that allows me to predict the quality of browned butter from factors like where in the world it's made or what time of year or anything like that or what the cows are eating. It's not a whole lot of information there.
That's so fun. If I was just tuning in now, I would full on think we're talking with a food scientist today.
I guess it shows that, you know, once you've got the scientific principles and the engineering principles as well, you can apply it to kind of any problem that you come across.
Totally.
Yeah.
So stick with us for part two, where we're going to talk more with Tim about some of his engineering work.
If you're a STEM researcher or professional that's heard the show today and are thinking to yourself, "Oh, I'd quite like to go on that show, that seems fun," we'd love to hear from you via our social media channels or at thatscience.org.
You're listening to That's What I Call Science, and today we're talking about engineering with our guest Tim Jessop from Currawong Engineering. My name is Sarah Lydon, and I'm joined by Ollie Dove. So Tim, could you tell us now a little bit about an interesting engineering project that you've worked on?
Oh, sure. I've worked on a few different projects, worked for a few different companies. Probably the most interesting one, at least for other people, is the company I worked for when I was in New Zealand for a little while, Martin Jetpack. So they made an experimental aircraft. It's kind of a single-person vertical takeoff aircraft. Technically not a jetpack because it was not a jet engine. It was a twin-ducted fan. So basically giant fans sitting out to the side of the pilot that sort of just blow air downwards. So I worked on the aircraft itself a little bit, but most of my time there I was spent working on the remote control system for that, or the ground control station, as we call it. So the idea is when you're flying a jetpack, it's pretty dangerous. They are an inherently dangerous form of transportation. And so the more you can test without a pilot actually in the aircraft, the better. So what we did for a lot of our experimentation with this aircraft was we would just have some weights on there instead of a pilot, and we would remotely control it from the ground and just have a drone pilot basically flying around with walking around with a remote control system, which I worked on.
With the word jetpack, I imagine something from Spy Kids where you put on a backpack and you're off. But given that you're saying aircraft, how big are we talking? How big is this piece of machinery?
Yeah, you couldn't really walk around with it. Like I said, jetpacks are inherently dangerous. You know, if you're flying a plane then and the engine cuts out, you can glide to a soft landing. And even if the engine on a helicopter dies, there's also some ability to glide to a landing there. Jetpacks don't have wings or propellers that can save you in that sort of situation. So if something goes wrong, you're basically dead, right? Which is probably why we don't see many people flying around in jetpacks, sadly. What this company tried to do, so Martin Jetpack, the one that I was working on, was they tried to make it a little bit safer. So they had a little bit of a roll cage, just a very small one, basically outlined the body of the pilot. And they had a parachute on top, a ballistic parachute, which would basically explode outwards and shoot a parachute out, which would ideally save the pilot if something went wrong with the engine and they were falling towards the ground. So that made it a bit heavier than you would imagine from, you know, the Jetsons or whatever else, but a lot safer.
What's the goal or the overall aim of developing this technology?
Oh, I think it was probably just a bit of fun to start off with. Somebody, the guy who came up with it, Glenn Martin, just did it in his garage to start with. And then I think there were a few potential commercial uses for it. So you know, flying around and inspecting things or search and rescue, stuff like that. Mm. Yeah, a few different applications just where it's not practical to have a full-on helicopter. And a drone might not be sufficient for what you need. You know, maybe you could have a paramedic who can fly out to a thing, land in a dangerous spot where a helicopter couldn't land, and then get off and actually provide some help to someone. So that was some of the ideas.
Yep. I imagine that if it keeps getting developed within 10 years, we'll see it like squirrel suiting. It will become like a danger, oh, what's the word, a junkie, adrenaline junkie sport?
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Oh, absolutely. That'd be fantastic.
What other engineering projects have you been involved in that may keep people on the ground a bit more?
Well, I guess I did some geotechnical engineering. I did electronics projects within the field of geotechnical engineering. So the company that I worked for, this is also in New Zealand, a company called Geosolve, they were doing, the boss had some ideas about how we could maybe detect landslides and the movement of ground after an earthquake or something like that, which we see a lot of in New Zealand. And then warn people, you know, if they were in a dangerous spot. So there were some areas where people were a bit concerned that, you know, there was a lot of steep ground around, and if there was an earthquake, then the land might move and they might not know. So I worked on a project to sense landslips and immediately send an alarm to the control room or wherever people were and tell them to basically get out.
So can you tell us a little bit about some of the engineering principles and practices that you've used in your work?
So a lot of the time that I was working for this company called SIF Technologies, a lot of that time I was actually traveling, and so working with instruments around the world that often when something had gone wrong, I'd be kind of sent over there to figure out what had gone wrong and try and fix it. So whenever you're trying to fix an instrument, it's a bit of a scientific process. So there's a lot of isolating of variables, you know, simplifying the system down to component parts and trying to, you know, work out which part of the system can you, or which parts of the system can you turn off without it changing the behavior of the system. And if you find that you can completely disconnect, you know, one component from the system and it doesn't change the way it's behaving, that can often tell you that that component is not doing its job or not contributing. So there's a lot of that scientific process even within engineering and troubleshooting. And I guess I've applied that to brownies as well.
It all comes back to brownies every time. And you're currently with Currawong Engineering. Mm. What do they do?
So I've just started with Currawong, so my knowledge about what they do might be a little bit shaky. But most their main sort of products are to do with UAVs, or unmanned aerial vehicles. A lot of people know them as drones. And they make some systems for power distribution, I guess. So if you have a battery on your drone and you have some propellers on your drone, you need some systems to basically determine how much power goes from that battery to the propellers, and also, you know, what happens if you suddenly turn the motors off and have energy running through the system still. So it's actually a lot of complex engineering goes into that kind of movement of power from one place to another. And so Currawong Engineering do some very, very high-tech, very lightweight, and very impressive sort of modules that people can buy and put into their drones or their aircraft.
So stick with us, listeners, for part three as we talk more with Tim Jessop about his work in chemistry and engineering.
If you're enjoying the show today, make sure you check us out on Instagram or Twitter at ThatScienceTaz, on our website, thatscience.org, or on Facebook at That's What I Call Science.
You're listening to That's What I Call Science, and today we are talking about chemistry and engineering. My name is Sarah Lydon, and I'm joined by Ollie Dove, along with our expert guest, Tim Jessop. So what is one impact that engineers make on society which you think is poorly understood by the general public?
Oh, I think most of my career has been focused around technology, and so creating new technologies. I think people understand that that's a thing that engineers do, but it often maybe don't appreciate everywhere that technology shows up and might impact their lives. So to talk about SIFT-MS, the mass spectrometry technology that I worked on, they would have systems. One of their big applications was container safety. So if a shipping container comes in from overseas, then often it has to be fumigated to kill off any pests or anything that, you know, to prevent them from coming into Australia, where, you know, we've got great biosecurity. And on a couple of occasions, people actually, sort of customs agents, walked into those containers to do inspections and actually died because the fumigate levels in those containers were still too high. It's basically a poison that kills bugs as much as it kills humans, I guess. And so one of the applications for our technology, SIFT-MS, was to measure the gases in those containers and report the concentrations of different fumigants, different toxic compounds, and tell the customs agents, the border security agents, whether or not it was safe to enter. And the same technology can be applied to healthcare or safety or, you know, monitoring airports for explosives or anything like that. So there's all sorts of ways in which the technology that we often work on is very much in the background. You know, if it's doing its job right, then you never know about it. It's just everything goes safely and smoothly and, yeah, nobody's hurt.
Yeah, and when it comes to STEM, with STEM meaning science, tech, engineering, maths and medicine, I feel like everyone always sees science as underlying the rest of STEM. Mm. But in actual fact, it probably is engineering, because you couldn't do a lot of STEM without any aspect of engineering. In terms of having worked in both chemistry and engineering for a while now, and, you know, a lot of people might be more aware of what chemistry does, or at least remember it from school, but we don't exactly study engineering at school. Have you seen any differences in the way, say, you're telling someone what you're doing at the time, mm-hmm. and you tell them about a chemistry project or team you're in, or an engineering one? Are there any differences in the way people engage or are interested or are aware of that sort of field?
I think people tend to be more interested in the engineering, to be honest. I think a lot of people find the technologies is actually a more understandable side of things. Like chemistry, you can very quickly get down into details that just don't affect people in their real life, or at least not that they're aware of. Whereas, you know, a jetpack, everyone knows what a jetpack is, and they're excited about it, even though they'll, you know, probably never fly one. And so I've personally had people be more interested in the technology. But I disagree. I think science really does underlie all of that, because in all of my work, it's first and foremost been a process of understanding how the thing works. Maybe understanding how two chemicals react and why they react in that particular way can allow you to make a device that can measure the presence of one of those chemicals. And so I really find that engineering is the application of scientific knowledge with a bunch of interesting techniques. So there's obviously, you know, understanding it is one thing, and then building the thing is really where most of your time in engineering is spent. But you really do need to understand the underlying science, physics or chemistry or whatever, before you can build any of those products.
And going on from that, if one of our listeners was tuned in right now and was thinking, I want to then go into the field that he's working in and have a career like that, what advice would you give them, given should they go and study science alongside with engineering, or just go straight into engineering?
Oh, if they want, oh man, I kind of did both just because I couldn't really decide. I thought it would be, you know, more of a challenge to do engineering, but my heart at the time was definitely on science, and to some extent I think it still is. And what I enjoy most about engineering is not so much the design side of things, but actually the investigation side of things. So understanding why something's not working, or you know, how it works, and yeah, understanding rather than making new things necessarily. I think depending on what motivates you, then either one of those fields could be good.
Another big question that might be even too big to answer, besides from brownies, if there was another recipe that you could spend, what has it been now, 8 years investigating, what would you pick next?
I mean, I think cookies would also be really interesting to get into, like just a really good chocolate chip cookie recipe.
They are hard. Like, I think cookies are even harder than brownies, because a brownie, you can maybe go for a more cakey version or a soft version, but a cookie, you can get a bad cookie.
Yeah.
Real easy.
That's a really good point. And there is a lot of overlap there, I think, between brownies and cookies. So there's definitely some, it wouldn't be entirely starting from scratch. You can take browned butter and the right sort of salt and that sort of thing. You can apply all of those to cookies as well as brownies, and you could, I think, get pretty far on that too. But a really, really good chocolate chip cookie is just incredible.
You just can't beat it. I look forward to seeing your recipe book one day. Well, that was fantastic. Thank you for coming in and making me feel kind of hungry. And I'm glad it's approaching tea time, so I can actually go get a cookie and a brownie now. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in to That's What I Call Science. We love bringing you STEM-related content and really hope you enjoyed the show. If you loved the episode today, you can get in touch with us by searching That's What I Call Science or That Science Taz on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, or LinkedIn. My name is Ollie Dove, and I'd like to thank my co-host Sarah Lydon and our expert guest Tim Jessup for joining me today. From the three of us here, we hope you all have a wonderful week. This program was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Find out more at cbf.org.au. That's What I Call Science is brought to your station and across the nation via the Community Radio Network. You can find the show at all major podcast streaming services and find out more about us from our social media channels. Make sure you like and subscribe to keep up with all the exciting science, technology, engineering, maths and medicine research in Lutruwita, Tasmania. This show is supported and strengthened by Edge Radio, so head over to edgeradio.org.au for more information about them. Thanks for tuning in today, and may your week be STEM-tastic.
Listening to Edge Radio, Hobart's premium youth station. My name is Kate Johnson from That's What I Call Science. Each week we have a guest from science, technology, engineering, maths or medicine on the show to tell us about the fascinating research being done here in Tasmania. If you want to hear more, make sure you tune into Edge Radio on Fridays at 10 a.m. or on Sundays at 5 p.m.